Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. George H.W. Bush was born to wealth, privilege, and connections with the East Coast elite with whom he schooled and socialized. He could have chosen a comfortable berth on that train. Instead, he struck out for Texas with his new bride and traveled a different, perhaps bumpier, but altogether more interesting route to the highest office in the nation. Along the way, he mostly made friends, and his friendly demeanor resonated in his inauguration speech on January 20th, 1989.
America is never wholly herself unless she is engaged in high moral principle. We as a people have such a purpose today. It is to make kinder the face of the nation and gentler the face of the world. My friends, we have work to do.
Today, we're talking about the life and times of George H.W. Bush with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer John Meacham. His latest book is entitled Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. John Meacham joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's pretty hard to deny the impact of George H.W. Bush on the American political and international landscape. He was a one-term president, but spent most of his adult life in public service. He really wanted to be where the action was. How do you summarize his legacy? It seems so multifaceted.
Well, I think he was the last consensus president. He was the last president we had who genuinely believed in and understood how to reach across the aisle in an effective way. His best friends were Democrats. He believed in a political universe in which campaigning was one thing and governing was another. He left us a more stable world after the end of the Cold War, and actually left a pretty significant domestic legacy, though he's widely mocked for not having done so. He passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. He passed the Clean Air Act, passed the 1990 budget deal that Bill Clinton will tell you helped set the conditions for the prosperity of the 1990s. You're talking about a president who, like as Tennyson wrote of Ulysses, was a part of all that he had met. And he'd had a wide-ranging, almost unparalleled life experience that enabled him to the highest office and reach out.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the life and times of George H.W. Bush. My guest is John Meacham. He's the author of the new book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. If you have a question or a comment, you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Again, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a quick break and reestablish that call with John Meacham. Again, we're talking about the life and times of George H.W. Bush with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer John Meacham. The book is entitled Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. We just heard from John Meacham about the impact of George H.W. Bush on the American political and international landscape. He called him the last consensus president in our history, at least so far. He wrote that George H.W. Bush was a steward, not a seer. 614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. The book by John Meacham has raised lots of eyebrows, not surprisingly, because George H.W. Bush talks about his opinion of his son, the 43rd president's time in office. John Meacham, back with us. Hello, John Meacham.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks again. You wrote that he was a steward, not a seer.
Yeah. Well, he was someone who saw his role as president, really all of his political offices, as in a truly conservative fashion. He was distrusted by his own right wing, but he was a conservative in the sense that he believed in managing reality as it came to him, and did not believe in sudden revolutionary change. Interestingly, Ronald Reagan did. You know, it's almost impossible to imagine a Bush revolution, but the Reagan revolution has become part of the American lexicon. So what Bush was, ultimately, was the last president of the World War II generation, first president of the post-Cold War era, and the last president for whom bipartisanship was part of his ambient reality. It was not something that he had to work at in the sense of, oh, I guess I better do that. It was just the way he had come up within the various offices he had held, beginning, really, when he was a congressman under Lyndon Johnson.
And that was the way he was.
Absolutely. He, as a child, he was known as Half-Half Bush, because he would cut a candy bar in half or cut a dessert in half to give the other half to the other kid. He was, his brother, Jonathan, had a wonderful phrase about him. He said that George had an innate empathy. And I think that's exactly right. You know, he became president, interestingly, not despite a lack of charisma, which is what I think a popular impression would be, but because he did have a quiet, persistent charisma. He impressed person after person, assignment after assignment, decade after decade, as he rose to the pinnacle.
That innate empathy, and yet at the end of his career, he had a reputation as a rich guy out of touch with the concerns of everyday Americans. Everyone seems to remember his reaction to the grocery store scanners. What did you learn about his sensibilities when it comes to everyday problems of Americans? How far does that empathy reach, or is it always just a one-on-one kind of a thing?
No, I think it's an unfair caricature, and it Lord knows, as you're exactly right, it took hold strong, and it's still there. You know, he did understand, and one of the things that was so fascinating about this project was using his diary, which he kept, he dictated as president once, twice, three times a week sometimes, and he clearly understood the economic realities. He understood that there was a lot to be done on the middle-class front, but he also had this kind of difficulty showing emotion. He didn't have a difficulty feeling emotion, but he had a very difficult time communicating, as he put it, his heartbeat. And I think part of it was, well, there are two reasons, really. One is he'd grown up in a world where he wasn't supposed to talk about himself. I think that led to part of his occasional battles with the English language. he had a difficult time saying I, he had a difficult time communicating that, you know, a personalized vision, political vision, the exact opposite, for instance, of Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton, his successor and his predecessor. The second thing, I think, is he had an innate dignity, and believed that the presidency was not an emotive office. I think that was a misunderstanding of the presidency, but it was firmly his view of it.
And he wasn't exactly surrounded by people who stopped and said, hey, you know, maybe you need to show more emotion. They were of like mind with him.
Well, you know, it's just, you know, when you're in your 60s and you're president of the United States and you've just run a war, the first Gulf War, and you're dealing, you know, with Mikhail Gorbachev trying to bring an end to the defining conflict of the second half of the 20th century, you know, it's hard. one of the reasons I do what I do is one of the purposes of political biography, I think, has to be to show the human forces that play in the more clinical political arena. And the George Bush of 1991-92 was not as active, was not as energetic as the George Bush of 89-90 and the first couple of months of 1991. Part of that was a health issue. He had a thyroid condition that I think was more of a factor than we've appreciated. He understood that the economy was going to be the main issue in 1992, well before the pundits. It wasn't an arrogance. That annoys me sometimes. People think that because he'd won the Gulf War, he felt entitled to a second term. George Bush never felt entitled to anything. It's one of the remarkable aspects of the remarkable family saga that you've described. You were, as a Bush, expected to compete, to be be in the arena, but you were expected to earn it. There was no coasting on the family name. There was nothing taken for granted. This was a highly competitive, highly energetic family with roots, by the way, in Columbus, of course.
Yep, right.
Prescott Bush was born there. Samuel P. Bush, his grandfather, ran Buckeye Steel Castings. So a significant part of the Bush ethos comes from your neighborhood.
Oh, from the Midwest in general.
And St. Louis. Yeah, the mm-hmm. Walkers were in St. Louis. The Bushes were in Columbus. And they only came east, really, in 1920, 21. So he had a Gilded Age Midwestern sensibility coming from both his mother and his father.
Your other biographies were of people long gone. You had unprecedented access to not only interview the 41st president and his family and associates, but also to his diaries. They were audio diaries, many of them, letters and so forth as well. How did the tenor of his life compare to what you discovered from telling the stories of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson? What was that? What was the contrast or comparison?
That's a great question. The thing they have in common, that most political lives have in common, is the tension, perennial tension, between ambition and service, between self-interest and the national interest. And I think that Bush comes out incredibly well in terms of having, when it really counted, putting his understanding of the national interest ahead of his short-term political view. He did it in 1990 when he broke the Read My Lips, No New Taxes pledge. He did it in 1968 when he voted for open housing while he was a congressman from a conservative district in Houston. He did it after the 88 campaign, which, as you will remember, was not a PBS or NPR-sponsored, high-minded account of what was facing the nation. But he did try to create a culture of consensus and compromise in Washington, because he thought that was what the national interest required. The technical difference between writing about the long dead and the living is, interestingly, there was almost more information available on George H.W. Bush than on Jefferson or Jackson, or even Franklin Roosevelt to some extent. An immense amount of raw diary entries of material that had not been put in the historical conversation yet, and so it was a tough decision when you deciding when to put something in and when to take it out, because I consider this book to be the beginning of a conversation, not in any way the last word, about a really remarkable political life who shaped the last half century of American life. He first ran for the Senate in 1964, 51 years ago.
Why do you say it's the beginning of a conversation? There's that much more?
Well, history, is, we always judge it to some extent by what's happening in our own time. You look at Harry Truman, for instance. Truman left Washington, I think, with an approval rating below 30%. But come Watergate, he became this really compelling figure, and the Truman Renaissance took place. I think Senior Bush's life resonates more today because of the highly partisan atmosphere of the current moment. But something may look different 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. You know, different generations have to interpret and reinterpret history in light of what it necessarily. In light of what concerns them the most, and we just don't know what that'll be.
I'm talking with John Meacham, author of Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 1988, George H.W. Bush was Vice President of the United States and looking to fill the nation's highest office. At the Republican National Convention that year, he made a pledge on taxes that would become his catchphrase.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips. No new taxes.
That statement, read my lips, no new taxes, would later haunt President Bush when running for re-election against Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton. Today we're talking about the life and times of George H.W. Bush with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer John Meacham. His latest book is entitled Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Thanks again for joining us, John.
Thank you.
You made the salient point in your prologue that Americans unhappy with the reflexively polarized politics of the first decades of the 21st century will find the presidency of George H.W. Bush refreshing, even quaint. But he could see the storm on the horizon when it came to the split in the Republican Party. And for that, I give him credit as being a seer. He certainly saw it. How did he cope with it?
Not well. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, three things happened sort of beneath Bush's feet as he was president that helped create the politics of 2016. One was the rise of the 24-hour news cycle. Bush didn't have to deal with the Internet, but he did have to deal with cable TV, and that was beginning, as well as the rise of conservative talk radio, which was becoming ever more important. The second was the emergence of the much more emotive Clintonian kind of "I feel your pain" politics, and that was something that he was uncomfortable with. And the third was the rise of freelance partisanship, embodied by Newt Gingrich, who revolted against the president when Bush decided in the summer of 1990 that, in fact, he had to raise some taxes. Interestingly, his first deal did not involve raising income taxes. It was only after the Republican Party in the House bolted on him that he ended up having. He was in a weakened position, and they got even a worse deal. But I asked President Bush once, "What's your major regret in your political life?" And he said, "I shouldn't have said read my lips." And he wasn't really kidding. He sort of smiled, but. Absent that pledge, the right wing, as it's taken shape, the reflexively anti-tax supply side wing of the party, would have had less to chew on than it ultimately did.
You wrote that in 1992 he lost an election, but not his place in history. How did he react to being a one-term president? There was, of course, the immediate anguish. He didn't show it, but he felt it. Oh, certainly, he talked to you about that.
Yeah, it was, as he put it, ghastly. It was incredibly difficult, and I think it probably still hurts a little bit. Bob Dole once asked George McGovern when it stopped hurting, and McGovern said, "I'll let you know." So I think it's incredibly painful. Basically, he'd gone from an approval rating right after the first Gulf War of about 89%, higher than even Truman after VJ Day, to having only 37% of the country wanting him to be in charge of their affairs. And so that was a remarkable collapse. Interestingly, he intuited it. He never believed the big numbers were going to hold. He did believe the economy would be the central issue, way ahead of the pundits. But 1992 was a perfect storm. I mean, there was Pat Buchanan, who was emboldened to challenge President Bush in the primaries, in part because of Bush's apostasy against Reaganism by raising the taxes. Mm-hmm. There was Ross Perot, of course, and there was Bill Clinton. I mean, we can't take often people talk about 1992 as if Clinton were some sort of walk-on actor. He is one of the most talented politicians in American history, and so Bush just was trapped in a vortex that proved overwhelming.
We have an email from Kevin. He asks, can you discuss his time with the CIA? My theory is that he was most likely running the country the last 2 years of Reagan's presidency. I also wonder how his experience running the CIA gave him insights that previous presidents didn't have as to how things really work in Washington and in the underbelly of the world. You know, John Meacham, you write pretty extensively, obviously, about that time and that he took over then at a very troubled time.
He did. He came back from China to take over the CIA in December 1975, January 1976. He was only there for a year, and yet the agency loved him. They named the building after him. The building at Langley is the Bush Intelligence Center. A couple of things. I think the CIA experience taught him that everything was not always as it seemed. He also believed very much in the value of electronic and the science and technology side of things in terms of detecting whether armies are massed at a certain border or whether there were troop movements. What he was more skeptical of, I think this goes back to his CIA year, was human intelligence. He believed that the agency was not as good at judging and assessing motives, planning, that sort of thing. That the largest example of this, obviously, is the summer of 1990 when our electronic intelligence was picking up the massing of Saddam's armies along the Kuwaiti border, but no one was able to very effectively predict what Saddam was going to do. And so I think that it gave him a certain skepticism about the human intelligence side of things.
Your book garnered interest on many levels, of course, but not the least of which regarding his son, George W., the 43rd, his response to the 9/11 attacks. First, talk about how he was judged by his own father, Prescott Bush, who served in the U.S. Senate, and what that taught him about how to deal with his own political sons.
Well, the Bush code on this is very interesting, and it's counterintuitive. Basically, they are, in fact, freelance political actors within the family. There's not a single family ideology or creed by any means. Prescott Bush, born in Columbus, went to St. George's School in Rhode Island, went to Yale, served in World War One, went to Wall Street, became a senator in 1952, served in the Senate for 10 years, was a moderate to liberal Republican. He was someone who was part of a small movement, ultimately ineffective, to put a more liberal Republican on the ticket with Eisenhower in 1956, wanting to remove Richard Nixon, who was seen as too conservative. So Prescott Bush is over on that side of the spectrum. And then George H.W. Bush moves to Texas in 1948. Shaped by that world in the oil business, and he runs in 1964 as a Goldwater Republican. Not entirely comfortably, like a lot of people, like a lot of other Republicans. He was probably not as conservative as, certainly not as conservative as Goldwater, but if you wanted to win in that era, in that year, that's what you were. Senator Bush told an oral history interviewer from Columbia University that he had made a point of never telling his sons what to do, never saying, now you're going to be a lawyer or you're going to be a doctor or you're going to be in the business world. He believed that the children should make their own decisions. He was, of course, there to consult. And George H.W. Bush copied that code, carried on that code, and similarly, was always available to give counsel to his son, who as both a presidential candidate and as a president, but would never force himself, would never force an opinion, would never volunteer an opinion unless asked. And George W. Bush, candidly, asked some, but nowhere nearly as frequently, I think, as people presume.
He was the only president since John Adams to see his son also elected president. So how did the 41st president judge the 43rds? time in office.
Yeah, he thought that his son had was facing the most complicated geopolitical situation since Lincoln or FDR. He used both examples because of the bloodshed on American soil of September 11th. He was that reinforced his tendency not to complicate the incumbent president's life by volunteering opinions. George W. Bush did ask his father about Iraq. Bush Sr. said that if the man won't comply, you've got to do what you've got to do. He wrote him a letter after the Iraq War started in 2003, in which he said that the decision was the right one. That's not often the narrative people have in their heads.
Mm-hmm.
I think they want to believe that Bush was shaking his head unhappily about all of this, but the real time reality, the documentary record suggests something different. You know, it's incredibly difficult, I think, to be a former president in any event. President Bush once said to me, "Once you've sat at that desk, you have a very hard time envisioning anyone else sitting there."
Hmm.
He was talking about whether Bill Clinton might have some ambivalence about Senator Clinton's candidacy.
Hmm.
But given his son, it's a remarkable observation. Add that to the natural complexities of a father-son relationship, and you have a very emotionally complicated landscape. But I think I take the Bushes at their word on this, which is that the father saw his role as being a supportive father, telling his son, you know, bucking his son up, trying to offer unconditional love in an immensely complicated time, and not saying, "Hey, here's what you got to do about House Resolution 12." And I'm convinced after 9 years or so of working on this, that was, in fact, the basic dynamic.
George H.W. Bush had a history with Donald Rumsfeld, the 13th Secretary of Defense under President Gerald Ford, 21st Secretary of Defense under President George W. Bush. Talk to us about their history and why he was concerned about him.
Well, Rumsfeld and Bush were always rivals, going back to the 60s. They were young congressmen together. They were always in the mix for important jobs in the age of Nixon and the age of Ford. My own view is that the beginnings of the direct competition go back to when Gerald Ford had first become president, and George H.W. Bush, who was the chairman of the Republican National Committee during Watergate, raised the possibility of his becoming the White House chief of staff a couple of times. And Ford didn't bite and asked him to go to China instead. Ultimately, Rumsfeld got that job. And so this is, you know, they were circling each other, as happens in the political world. Bush always found Rumsfeld to be overly self-assured, not particularly open to other people's points of view, which was, in fact, a hallmark of Bush. I mean, Bush, if anything, was maybe too open to other people's points of view, was always willing to listen. George H.W. Bush's view of Rumsfeld is that he was not. And so they were in no way friendly or even allies. They were friendly. Let me amend that. This shows you something about the weird human dynamics at work in these situations. When Bush left for China, he actually loaned the Rumsfelds their family car, Bush's family car, because Rumsfeld was coming back from Brussels, where he had been ambassador to NATO. And so it was one of those rivalries that was all the more complex for being often submerged. But Rumsfeld was in the mix to be Reagan's vice presidential running mate in 1980 when Bush got it. Rumsfeld looked at running for president in 1988, ultimately endorsed Bob Dole against George Bush. Rumsfeld played no role in the Bush 41 administration, but because of his relationship with Dick Cheney, they had served together in the Ford White House. George W. Bush was open to bringing Rumsfeld in.
We have an email from Paul. He says, I would be interested in what Mr. Meacham learned in his research about how George H.W. Bush punished political foes. Recently, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd wrote that he and George W. Bush were good at tasking proxies to put the shiv into the sides of their enemies. Does Mr. Meacham have a comment on that quote?
Well, yes. I mean, there was a outsourcing the difficult political work is a sign of a good leader, I think, in many ways. But what's interesting to me about George H.W. Bush is that for having been a significant political player, again, for half a century, he has remarkably few enemies. He didn't have all that many opponents, interestingly. We've been talking about one. Rumsfeld is one. Mm-hmm. John Conley was one, back from the politics of Texas. Mm-hmm. Ross Perot, obviously, is one. But that's really about it. I mean, he and Bob Dole were very much at each other's throats in 1988 and ended up being quite close during the Bush presidency from 89 to 93. Bob Dole cried when he paid tribute to President Bush right after the 1992 election. So you look at Bill Clinton, you know, he and Bush have formed a genuine bond there. So did Bush outsource negative campaigning and that sort of thing? Absolutely. Does everyone? Pretty much, yeah. But what struck me, interestingly, was that he actually was, for someone at that level of politics for that long, he had remarkably few people that either he wanted to shiv or that wanted to shiv.
We are talking about the life and times of George H.W. Bush. My guest is author, biographer John Meacham, and the name of his recent book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. We will return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This hour, we're discussing the life and legacy of George H.W. Bush. During World War II, as a Navy pilot, he was shot down while on a mission in the Pacific. He parachuted to safety, landing in open water, and was eventually rescued by the crew from an American submarine. For his 85th birthday, he decided to skydive for a very different set of reasons.
There's two reasons for doing it. I've told these guys. One of them is that it feels good. There's an exhilaration, especially when you start out of the plane. You feel exhilarated and get charged up and excited. And that's not easy to do at 85. And then the other one is it sends a message around with these guys all around the globe that just because you're an old guy, you don't have to sit around drooling in the corner. Get out and do something. Get out and enjoy life.
Still with us by phone is Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer John Meacham. His latest book is entitled Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Having read your book, I finally understand why he wanted to skydive again.
Yeah, no, drooling in the corner is not his strong suit by any means.
Yeah, he just liked to push the envelope. The guy was really driven by adrenaline. Part of that probably was an addiction he formed early on with sports, I suppose, but he was always looking for something in exciting to do. He certainly could, as I mentioned very early in the program, taken a berth on a very comfortable train.
Oh, absolutely. He should have, you know, by all rights, you know, his life would have been circumscribed by Wall Street and the commuter world of New York. You know, he would have raised money for Republicans. He would have been a New England Republican, and we all know how well that turned out. so that, you know, that was not a pathway to power by any means. You know, interestingly, he moved south and west as the center of gravity in the country moved south and west. He, you know, was interested in making a lot of money quick. You know, he said, I don't make any apologies about that. He thought the oil business was the way to go. And was, in fact, driven by this enormous competitive streak that came to him from both his father, again, from Columbus, mm-hmm. and his mother from St. Louis, who were both, you know, sterling athletes, very respected people in their spheres. And I think that the expectations for Bush were always immense. But I don't think they were talked about very much. And I think they were more ambient than expressed, if you will. And I think they were all the more powerful for that.
From my reading, he couldn't have found a greater partner than Barbara Bush.
I think that's right. I think she was a incredibly resilient spouse. They lost a daughter to leukemia in 1953. Mrs. Bush kept the family together, body and soul, through the decades when her husband was off either building a business or building a political career. I think she was a ferocious defender of her husband, but in a very more subtle way than some other first ladies, Nancy Reagan, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
As President Bush once told me, Barbara was always subtle in her opinions to the staff and those around us, but to me, she wasn't subtle. And so I think that marrying Barbara Pierce from Rye, New York, and January of 1945 was one of the great seminal events in his life, to say the least. You'll appreciate this, I think. I was out giving a talk about the book somewhere in the past month or so in an audience, and I said, the Bushes have been married for 70 years, and a man who was sitting with his wife down front said, "Oh, my God." And I was thinking, man, you got a long ride home.
Exactly. You wrote that when he took over the CIA, I think it was then, that she was very frustrated that they couldn't talk about his work anymore. Was it during that period that she became depressed? I think it was about a 6-month period of depression for her.
That's
it was very,
right.
Very
exactly right. It was
traumatic.
The middle of the 1970s.
Okay.
China had been a wonderful experience for both of them. She was living, they were living in the diplomatic compound there in Beijing. Coming back to the CIA for the first time, he couldn't share any of his work, really. She did become depressed, had thoughts of driving off the road into a tree,
mm-hmm.
Very serious. And I think to his credit, George Bush was an incredibly supportive spouse by her account.
Mm-hmm.
Suggested that she get professional help, was very much there for her in the way that he had been with her and there for her in the wake of their daughter's death in the early 50s. Interestingly, Mrs. Bush was incredibly strong during the leukemia battle, and President Bush had a very hard time watching his daughter be treated, and so he would bolt out of the room. Mrs. Bush would stand sentinel. And then after Robin died, their roles reversed to some extent. Mrs. Bush would be crying late into the night, and it was George Bush who helped put her back together again at that point. So, their marriage survived and even became stronger through the vicissitudes of this long and storied marriage.
Rumors of infidelity on his part emerged during his first run for the presidency in the general election, I should say. The talk was rampant in October 1988 when I traveled with her in southern Illinois, and she would not answer any questions about the issue until I asked about the hurt that it caused. And then she sort of opened up and was talked at least ancillarily about it in those ways. What about that time and the effect on her? Did they talk about that with you?
I talked to President Bush about it, what happened was both in 1987 and in 1992, mm-hmm. The press corps had obviously dealt with the Gary Hart issues in 87, mm-hmm. and then sort of it was almost for equal treatment. They then began raising questions about George Bush. Through George W., interestingly, President Bush, Vice President Bush then, denied it. He denied it to me directly, as did the woman who was most frequently named. And so I think it was, and then in 1992, obviously, after the, you know, in the midst of all the Clinton stories, again, there was a kind of an equal opportunity look at George Bush's life. I don't think it's true. And I think that inevitably, in a long and complicated political life, you know, you're going to deal with this sort of thing mm-hmm. Along the way. Unfortunately, it's just part of the process.
You know, it's kind of difficult to read about the debate cycle during the Republican primary season in 1980 and not compare it to what's going on in 2015 and probably coming up in 2016. When it comes to GOP debates, really interesting dynamics. What was going on there? Why? Can you explain what the deal was? There were a lot more candidates than who attended the debates.
Well, there were in 1980. There were you had some real heavyweights. I mean, you had Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. you had George H.W. Bush, you had Bob Dole, you had Howard Baker, you had John Anderson, you had John Conley. You know, you had some. Phil Crane of Illinois,
yeah.
Some pretty significant folks, and there were fewer of them. There were still there were 5 weeks, I think, between Iowa and New Hampshire, which is one thing. This was only the second time. 1980 was only the second time Iowa had really mattered. President Carter had proven the significance of an Iowa victory in 76. George Bush and Jim Baker, his campaign manager, had studied that. They understood that if they could pull off an upset against Ronald Reagan, the front runner in Iowa, that there would be a chance to maybe run the table. And he did, in fact, do that. He did win Iowa, and then Reagan reasserted himself in the 5 weeks between Iowa and New Hampshire. And so what Bush had referred to as the big Mo, or momentum, was stopped there. But Bush kept going. He won Michigan, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Connecticut. You know, he won four primaries, two of them big industrial states. And had he not done that, had he not performed that well, Reagan would never have turned to him to become vice president. And if he hadn't been vice president, he told me, he's sure he wouldn't have been president.
Mm-hmm. But he had to buck up to become vice president. I mean, he didn't necessarily like Reagan before they joined forces.
No, they didn't know each other.
Right.
The threshold for friendship in Bush's universe was pretty much meeting George Bush. He and Reagan had a rough it had been a rough primary season. Bush had implied that Reagan was too old. Reagan was 69 years old through most of that campaign. Bush had referred to supply-side economics as voodoo economics. The idea that you could cut taxes and raise revenues, he thought was equivalent to voodoo. Reagan remembered all of this and, in fact, attempted to get President Ford back on the ticket as vice president. It was only after, very late in the game, on the penultimate night of the convention, that deal fell apart and Reagan picked up the phone to ask Bush to join the ticket. It's a measure of how things have changed that Ronald Reagan, a movement conservative, felt that he needed to balance the ticket with a more moderate conservative in 1980. He believed that picking George Bush as opposed to someone like Jack Kemp, perhaps, was more important for the general election. It's a sign of how far right the Republicans have moved that it's hard to imagine that calculus playing a role again.
You mean meaning that to balance a ticket in that way between a moderate and a conservative versus
Conservative.
Conservative and conservative.
Yeah.
Going back to the his opinions of his son's administration, we have an email from Clifford who asks, does George H.W. Bush place any blame upon Karl Rove for some of the policy misdirection?
No. President Bush believes that Bush 43 was in charge. He thought that Cheney had a disproportionate influence. He thought that Rumsfeld had been overly swaggering, that all of these things had created, including the son's own rhetoric, had created an atmosphere, an overly hawkish tone to the son's administration. But to his credit, and to President Bush 43's credit, he acknowledged it. Bush 41 believed that his son was in charge, and was the buck stops there, as he put it. He was responsible. He was in charge. And so to blame others would be wrongheaded. And when I asked, when I took all these comments to 43, he said, "Well, my father never said any of that to me, either during the presidency or after." And when I said, "Well, what about the hot rhetoric?" The senior Bush was particularly talking about axis of evil. He thought that calling, using the phrase axis of evil was diplomatically unhelpful. Bush 43 said, well, you know, my rhetoric could get pretty hot, but that he was dealing with a different strategic environment than his father had dealt with after September 11th, and that it was, as 41 once put it, you know, different wars, different reasons. And so so I think everybody was kind of a grown-up about the criticism. And I think the reason Bush 41 finally opened up and said what he said about Cheney and Rumsfeld and his son was that he believes in the historical record. And you don't keep a diary like the one 41 kept through the whole presidency if you don't believe that ultimately history matters, that there are lessons to be learned. And I think what he wanted to put on the record there was that force and diplomacy were not competitive with one another, but were complementary forces.
What's he like to talk to?
He's a lot like the clip you just played. he's very funny. A transcript of his remarks does not begin to capture the sense of what it's like to sit around with him. His mind moves very quickly. He is a fox, not a hedgehog, in the classic Isaiah Berlin dichotomy. He moves from subject to subject very rapidly. It's no wonder to me that press conferences were actually an effective means for him to communicate as opposed to set speeches. He's very well read and widely read, but as he puts it, you know, he doesn't want people to think he's an intellectual, which again is kind of a funny thing to say. But you know, I think that's Texas. You know,
yeah.
that was the man from Andover and Yale trying to run in Texas, not wanting to appear to be an elitist, as he would call it. So he's a remarkably decent man. You know, he's not perfect. I'm not making the case for the canonization of St. George of King Bunkport by any means. He had failings. He made mistakes. But he was and is a man of unusually good temperament and character and disposition who made his way at the highest levels of politics and I believe left the world in better shape than he found it.
Well, John Meacham, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
John Meacham, he's the author of Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Ryan McFadden and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.